kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 76, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Good evening, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm fine, in fact. Fully awake, chipper, all that kind of stuff. How are you feeling, Di?
I'm not so hot. I'm a bit sort of jet lagged, and I've never had jet lag before in this way. It's kind of a bit weird. So I've never sort of flown in and then had to, within 24 hours, had to get back home with working life, you know.
Flying forwards in time from the West Coast of America is brutal.
Yes, it is. So yeah, I didn't think it'd be a problem to me, and it has been. It's quite interesting. So I currently feel like I haven't slept for, like, sleep is not something that I do. I have no control over it. It's just so I don't respond. Yeah. So I've tried to do everything right. It's an interesting for anyone who travels, which I guess quite a few people will listen to this. So I arrived home at 9:30 on Sunday morning, drove to my flat, and stayed awake, did all my washing, did all the right things, had a nice sort of chilled day. And the children all came back from their homes to the boarding house and went to bed about 10 o'clock. It was all quite, I felt very tired at 7 o'clock, but I kept awake. And so I tried to put myself back.
Because you wanted a normal night's sleep, yeah?
Exactly. Yeah. And then to wake up and start teaching Monday morning. And then I did go to bed, but I ended up having a really broken night's sleep. And then at 5 to 6 in the morning, one of the boys set off the intruder alarm. Getting up too early, which was, I can't tell you.
You wanted to put it in thoughts.
So I got up, turned the alarm off, go down and see the other housemasters arrive, and to find out what the problem is, because we have to check all this, you know, where the problem is and whatever. It's quite angry. Anyway. Going back to sleep, got up quite late to teach. That was fine.
Managed. So Monday, not a problem. But
not a problem. Yeah, okay. Played football in the evening and was full of energy. Fantastic, not a problem. But wasn't tired. So I didn't go to sleep until midnight. Let's say for the sake of my professional decency or dignity, let's just say I didn't get up when my alarm went off in the morning, or indeed shortly afterwards. So,
oh dear.
So it's a real nightmare, to be honest. So it's all day. I felt like I hadn't slept all night, basically, and it's been a bit of a nightmare. So I have sort of good energy. It's a bit weird, but I have also this sort of vague doubt things, like I'll be looking for something that I'm holding in my hand and that kind of crap. It's not good. So anyway, I'll get over it.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things. I remember talking to Ewan McIntosh once, and he travels a lot now, I think he travels almost all the time now, but there was a time when he'd be away from home, like, for 6 weeks at a time and going, like, Japan, Australia, London, Berlin, do all this kind of stuff. And I said, how do you deal with the jet lag? Is it like Bruce Willis on Die Hard, where he says, make fists with your toes? He was like, no, it's all about eating. You have to kind of fool your body into thinking that you're in the new time zone already. So you eat for the time zone you go into. And so I still get jet lag, but as soon as I listened to his advice, he said, you know, part of it's mental as well. I started like refusing some of the food on airlines because I didn't feel like that was the right thing to do for the time zone I was going into. And whether it was entirely psychosomatic, it did improve the jet lag that I felt when I was flying kind of forwards in time.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. Because, yes.
And it's interesting, you know, when you speak to people who do literally travel all the time, like Gunnar, who does all of the facilitation stuff at MozFest. He uses something called melatonin, which is, you know, something which is naturally produced in our body, but you can buy it over the counter in the US where you can't buy it in the UK.
All right, okay. So he actually takes something to
counter. Yeah, it just kind of knocks you out and, you know, helps with your circadian rhythms and all that.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I think it's difficult. I mean, like long sort of 12-hour plane rides, which is pretty much was, because you're on the plane longer than you were flying, you see what I mean? And that's just painful, and it's just unpleasant, and you have to kind of get through. It's not too bad; you can endure that, but you can't really sleep on them very well. It's not so good, I think.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I guess people Yeah, it was. I mean, coming back and then having to teach the next day, that's hard.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you've been in San Francisco. What did you get up to after we spoke? Because you were in San Francisco last week when we spoke.
I was, yes. I got up to all sorts of loveliness. The thing I found most intriguing, I guess, about the city was I walked down from where I was staying down to the Caltrain, and I got the Caltrain down to Mountain View to meet a friend of mine who works at Google for lunch. And that was, so I had to walk through Tenderloin, which is kind of a rough area of San Francisco. And that was really interesting to me because I've lived in London for 20 years and know London, not inside and out, but I know its backside and it's good if you hit off front, but whatever. And going on the Caltrain, you kind of see behind the city and inside the city a little bit, you know what I mean? And then you go on this trip down the coast and see all the different areas as you go down, the affluent ones and not so affluent ones and that kind of thing. So that was really, really interesting and lovely. Meeting up with a gentleman called Logan Evans, who works at Google. And he is a friend of mine's brother. And I met him last summer. I think we probably discussed it here, possibly. I'm not sure.
Oh, we talked about, one worked at Facebook, one worked at Google, etc.
Yes, this is the one that worked at Google. So he's moved down to from Seattle down to here and down to there, Mountain View. And he doesn't work in the Googleplex. He works in, I think it was called Sun Valley or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And which is just not very far away. And Google are relocating a lot of their people there. And he is working on a really interesting project, which I think I've got my head around a little bit, which is he's working on. So he was a software engineer for Chromecast, and now he is working on. The programming that is present in a chip, effectively. So at the moment, every chip is designed to do one thing well, like process whatever. Mm. But once it's in situ, it can't be updated or upgraded. And the thing that he's working on is the ability to reprogram a chip remotely and send updates out to it
on the fly.
Yeah, and so therefore,
it's almost like virtualization of the chip then.
That kind of thing, yes. Yeah. So a chip become you can actually change how a chip is purposed.
Very interesting.
Architecture of the chip is purpose in itself.
Which means getting as close to Skynet, that's what it's all about.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's not irrelevant to that because as the Internet of Things is ever increasing, as it was promised back in the day, then this means that a chip that's in situ somewhere, so if you think of a chip in a car, for example, it's in that car and it'll be in there for a long time. And rather than changing the chip, which is not likely to happen, you can actually update the chip so it works in a different way and different software can therefore be used on it.
Interesting. Okay.
It was.
Well, last week I was at the Open Co-op 2017 conference. So I got the train down on Wednesday, had a meeting at the British Museum, the potential to do different work with the co-op there. But then on Thursday and Friday, the co-op that I co-founded with Laura Hilliger, Brian Mathers and John Bevan, we were facilitating, speaking at, being participants in the first ever Open Co-op conference. And it was all about platform cooperativism. So platform cooperativism is a coin coined by Trevor Schultz and Nathan Schneider. So Trevor Schultz is at the New School in New York. And Nathan Schneider's somewhere else. And they've written a book, which I've just ordered, so it should arrive soon. And it's all about trying to create things like, you know, Airbnb and Uber and Spotify and Twitter and stuff, but have them owned by the people who use them. So, you know, you own the thing that you're providing value towards. But like, you know, Facebook, people like Errol Balkan talk about Facebook farming people. So instead of that, you know, you're part of the, not only the profits, but deciding the future direction of it and what it's going to do and what it's not going to do, which is obviously right up our street. And some really interesting characters there. I think the concern going in was that it was going to be entirely new people and have no reference to the kind of old school cooperative movement. But actually, it was a mixture and some really good stuff going there. Trevor Schultz came over and spoke. John MacDonald, the shadow chancellor at Labour Party, he spoke. He was on a panel with Laura. And, some really good sessions. the person I was supposed to do in the session with, Primavera de Filippi, she was doing something on kind of blockchain as a platform. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, she messaged me on the morning of the conference, and she'd fallen off her bike on the way to the train station and cracked a rib. So it ended up being Brian and I doing a double hander, as we have done before, on badges and blockchain and online credentialing and all that kind of stuff. And it was good.
Cool.
Yeah. Enjoyed it.
So it was a good conference then. You were M.
Yeah, so it was at Goldsmiths University. And there were breakout sessions. And the thing which they'd done, which was smart, they'd left certain slots of the program open. And on the first day, they'd given over an hour of the program to people who wanted to use a particular... Yeah, so they were using a tool which I haven't seen before called Slido. So it's SLI.do. Mm-hmm. And you know Google Moderator, as was?
Yeah.
Where you could vote things up and down and you could suggest things. We used to use that in Mozilla for if there was like an all-hands meeting and 1,000 people on the line. You could prepare questions beforehand and the top voted ones would be asked and responded to. It's like that, and you can put it up on the screen, but it also has the hashtag of the conference so that you're only one click away on the website or the app from the Twitter feed. And also, not only can you ask questions, but they can run polls in there as well. It's a really slick bit of kit for when you're doing conferences, I have to say. So they used that, and they used it to get people's ideas for running an open session, you know, anyone having a breakout session, but like unconference style. And then people came onto the stage to pitch their idea. And it worked really well, and they combined some sessions and they updated the program based on feedback, and it all worked. I mean, it wasn't all entirely smooth, but then if a conference is all entirely smooth, it's usually just boring. So I really enjoyed it, went along to some sessions, went along to one by a lawyer, and this one was really interesting because he kept using terms which he then had to say, oh, but it doesn't really work like that with co-ops. So, for example, he said, he used the word investor, but he said, well, the word investor supposes that you're putting your money in and you're looking for a return, whereas the return isn't always financial, or you might not even be looking for a return at all when you're putting money into the co-op. And the investors, and putting in scare quotes again, can be anybody rather than just a certain class of person. And so what I went away thinking, Di, was that, as with anything, we need to spend some time defining terms and potentially coming up with new ones to define what it is that we're trying to do, as opposed to appropriating existing terms and using them in a clunky, roundabout way, which could be misconstrued.
Yes, that's difficult. It's a difficult thing to do, isn't it, really? Because you start making up new words or redefining words, but you don't want to redefine them. I mean, you don't want to make new words as such, but you want to have terms or phrases that actually apply to your situation. But it becomes difficult because you are in danger of isolating yourself because other people don't understand what the words are. Badges are a good example of this.
Yeah, exactly. And I always used to find it odd on when people would say things like inventor of the term, I don't know, platform cooperativism. And I'd be like, so what? So you're the first person to use a word. But then more recently, I've realized that that's a really powerful thing to do, to coin, you know, neologisms like Brexit or whatever it is, because what you're doing is, if you hit on the right term, it's descriptive enough for people to go, oh yeah, that. But it also has enough wiggle room for people to be able to do other stuff under that banner. So yeah, I've come to realize recently that coining new terms and words is a really powerful thing to do.
Yes, I think it's that's right. And I think it's also one of those things, it's a bit like writing a good song. Kind of thing. You know, it doesn't necessarily, you might think it has all the characteristics of a good song, etc., but it doesn't necessarily take hold, and it's up to other people to make it work, kind of thing as well.
And I suppose, yeah, absolutely, that's a good analogy, because like with songs, you could be, or even novels or paintings, you could be too early for it to be appreciated in your own lifetime. Like, was it Van Gogh only sold one painting during his lifetime?
Yeah, completely.
So yeah, you have to kind of harness the zeitgeist. Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Cool. Anyway, we're going to keep this pretty short because you need to go to bed. So I mean, the famous last words, but we are going to try and make this one slightly shorter. So with that in mind, shall we dive straight into the main topic today? Which
yes, let's do it. I promise to do my best to hold thought in mind. We'll see what happens. So you put a link in here, which is, and the title is, but you don't really want it to be about this link, which is a draft post that you've written for DML Central about educational solutionism. But the post is entitled, possibly controversially, Against Evidence-Based Educational Solutionism.
Mm. Now, just quick background to this. So a couple of things. First of all, I don't know if you've read Yevgeny Morozov's book about technological solutionism.
I have not.
It's called To Solve Everything, Click Here. And, you know, he does a pretty good job both in that and in his Guardian articles of eviscerating the Silicon Valley narrative about, well, all we need to do is invent something new and that'll solve that. It's very much a engineer's mindset of, oh, well, how hard can solving the education system be? We'll just create an app for it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he does a great job of deconstructing that narrative. And I don't know, have you seen this more recently? I mean, I think your network is slightly stronger in terms of kind of teachers and educators than mine, I'm not sure. But there's been stuff going around, especially one particular slide, which has been shared. And it kind of the gist of it is that, well, if you're not using evidence for your decision making, then you must be using prejudice. Have you come across that kind of view?
Okay. Sir Kevin Collins, CEO of EEF. Yes, I have sort of come across it. I don't. I mean, it just seems a little bit crass, doesn't it, to me? In that it's possibly so rather than discuss. So when you make a decision, you're always basing it on some kind of evidence. You know, you can't help but do so. You're not randomly picking it. So that evidence might be your own knowledge and interpretation of what you see around you and what you've observed and read and such like. You're always going to be basing it on some kind of evidence. So the idea of this statement is that without any evidence, if you remove evidence, then you have to be doing it with prejudice because you're left at being pushed or manipulated by your own experience.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And the thing which I mean, it's a nice soundbite, and it's quite compelling is the wrong word, but it's quite seductive in its simplicity. So, mm-hmm. Oh, if it's not evidence, it must be pressure. Oh, right, yeah, okay. But then, of course, when you scratch the surface, you realize, well, there's no such thing as kind of theory. You know, you can't have theory-free evidence because when you were looking for the evidence, you had to have some kind of theory about what was going to happen, and you're always interpreting the data. And then if you look at the other term, prejudice, well, why does it have to be prejudice? Couldn't it be, I mean, Sue Cowley pointed this out. She wrote that book, Getting the Buggers to Behave, and she, I mentioned her book last week. She said it doesn't have to be evidence in that sense. It could be intuition, or it could be common sense, yeah. Or it could be like a gut feeling, yeah?
Yes. And I think it's an interesting thing as well in that, so if we take decisions that schools make, for example, they will invest in a platform for learning management like a VLE of some sort, like Moodle, or we use Firefly. And what I experience a lot of other people do is they look at what's going on in other schools and think, well, we'll use that one because they're all using that, or you know, this collection of schools are using this product. So we'll go with that product because it must be the right thing, without necessarily talking to the schools or indeed getting the truth of what it is that they're doing. Do you know what I mean? So if you talk to me about Firefly, I tell you what it does and what it achieves. And if you're looking to choose a VLE, this process possibly that you need to go through or your school needs to go through.
Yeah, it's almost like a...
arrive at that decision.
It's almost like a herd mentality. So it's kind of the advertising slogan, oh, you know, 500,000 people can't be wrong. Well,
yeah,
they could, for in your context.
They certainly could, and that's often the case. I mean, that's what happened with interactive whiteboards. It's people in certain situations or certain positions get a set of information that they trust and believe, and then they say, there certainly are weapons of mass destruction. Let's go and annihilate them all. Oh, we were wrong. Crap. or whatever, you know. So you Yeah, and you end up with these wholesale mistakes, which certainly from my talkings with Dick Taylor, who has a big handle on, has written a really interesting article recently on corruption in Australian at corporate level ed tech, and tried to expose it in a way, but it's certainly the feeling I get from him when talking to him about ed tech companies.
Yeah, it's difficult because there's, you can always point to evidence to back up your own worldview. I mean, we've talked at length about fake news under the guise of safe internet and all that kind of stuff. And if you go looking for evidence to back up your opinion, you will find it, because it depends how high your threshold is for the evidence you're looking for to back up your worldview.
Did I talk about this last week when we did it, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, I think, when we did a switch to a two-week timetable at my previous school? It didn't do my subject any favours, so I argued against it. So I took the 36 points, whatever it was, that they'd posited as the advantages of moving to a two-week timetable, and poo-pooed each of them systematically, not in a kind of, you know, light and silly way, but just in a kind of this thing. And the person leading the meeting, a deputy head at the time, said that, well, education all comes down to a matter of opinion in the end anyway, doesn't it? And I thought that was quite interesting. Not about evidence whatsoever. So when, you know, they had picked this evidence and decided that these things were good, I had wider concerns about it diluting the quality of the education delivered to the children and that kind of thing. And over time, and so whereas it seemed like a sensible fix in the short run, these things weren't actually blah, 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 and it all came down to a matter of opinion. So my opinion didn't count and it didn't matter. Let's move on.
Well, I mean, in a banal sense, that's true, isn't it? That's the reason why we have different types of schools. That's why, you know, people can choose to educate their children privately, send them to a faith school, you know, do all that kind of stuff. But yeah, what you're talking about there with a timetable and subjects and division of subjects and stuff seems to be beyond just a preference. It seems to be something which you could claim to be a bit more objective about.
Yes, I mean, it's actually, if you look at academic research, it's quite interesting. So I've only done a master's and you've done a PhD as well as a master's, so you know more about this than me, I would hope. But the idea is that you have to set your terms of measurement, your terms of evidence. So what you're looking to establish and how credible that evidence is and all your assumptions, et cetera, et cetera. So like your terms of engagement with the research. So you can actually come up with something at the end that you can say, in these circumstances, this is the case. And there's that thing. Is it something you put in your newsletter, actually, something about evidence research or action research in education is very rarely iterated. It's very rarely repeated and reproven, if you know what I mean. Is that everyone was always tweaking and changing what they were doing, so you could never do the thing.
In this. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's almost some of it relates to funding, but it's almost a cliche in educational research or any type of research. You know, at the end of it, to say further research is needed.
Yes, of course, all that kind of stuff.
And that just goes to show that there is no full stop. You know, if you go to my thesis page, neverendingthesis.com, I quote, I think, George Lucas, who made Star Wars, by saying, a film is never finished. You just have to stop working on it at some point. And it's the same with researching what works in education. So loads of people cite John Hattie and his work and whatever, and he did a meta-analysis. I did a meta-analysis in my thesis as well. Could I have included more stuff? Could I be still doing that work? Absolutely. There comes a time when you have to stop working on it and present your findings to the world. But the problem is, and yeah, it's difficult to say this without sounding elitist or whatever, but the people who are trying to make sense of the work that you've done haven't gone down that tunnel with you, and therefore don't get the context, and also potentially aren't working that level as well. So your job is to explain the nuance and explain why that might work in that situation or might not work in that situation. And, you know, I particularly have a bugbear with Hattie's research because it's taken as objective fact in every situation and for all time by people who, for example, want to say, Hattie's research shows that class sizes don't make much of a difference. Well, yes, in the stuff that he had a look at, and you know, so it's a difficult thing to massively generalize, even from when you've got as much data as possible. And the thing you mentioned there, I've just stuck in, I'm still linking actually, Inside Higher Ed, 2014 article, which shows that actually most educational research is not replicated. So it is never retested to see if it works in a different context or 2 years down the line or whatever.
I mean, that is one of the things that I found about Hattie's work when I looked at it in detail, which is years ago now, is that I was never happy with how he lined up different... So he took hundreds and hundreds of different research evidence and aligned it, basically. And, you know, to align one... I would find it difficult to align one set of research to another. It's difficult unless you're actually setting out to execute that research with the same body of people or to the same set of assumptions and in each instance, do you know what I mean? So like an umbrella approach, then you don't get it, you know, it just doesn't happen.
And so it's easy to think, well, should we just throw our hands in the air and say, well, it's impossible to point to any evidence, or everyone points to their own evidence, so there's no point in, you know, throw the baby out of the bathwater. And I guess, so I've had some pushback on this, especially from Mimi Ito. So Mimi Ito is extremely well known in my world, 2 PhDs, Joey Ito's sister, who runs MIT Media Lab, professor at University of California, and just huge in my world. So amazed that she commented on this draft that I wrote. I guess it's because I mentioned there was for DML Central. And her point is that this is a pretty dangerous thing to write at a time of Trump, because you seem to be throwing the baby out of the bathwater in terms of we shouldn't need any evidence. And someone could legitimately read this and say, well, oh, I can just base policy or whatever on any ideology I want, and it doesn't make any difference. And so I think I need to rewrite this. And again, this podcast isn't really about this article. It's about the links in it. But I guess the point I was trying to make is that when people point towards evidence-based educational research, they're starting from a position like a worldview. They're starting from the position that things that can be measured and evidence can be provided, usually in the form of test results, they are the things that matter, and that counts as, quote, what works in education. And I don't think that's true.
I think that's fair to say. It's different. I mean, it's a massive, massive issue, isn't it? And I think, so I'm always, when I think about this, I'm always reminded of being a 17-year-old economist studying A-level economics. And Nigel Lawson at the time, I believe, made a change in the budget that unleaded petrol and diesel, would have 8 pence difference between them. His intention was that the price of diesel would be lowered, I believe. And that's not what they did. They obviously just raised the price of unleaded. All the companies raised the price of unleaded, and much to his frustration, or indeed his public frustration, I'm not sure if it was frustration or whether he expected that to happen. But as a naive 17-year-old, I remember thinking, well, that was pretty obvious that was going to happen. Why did he do that? I don't understand. Isn't this guy supposed to have some brains about him? And it's a bit like that, isn't it? If you take away the idea, I guess what Mimi's saying is, if you take away the idea of basing things on evidence, especially in a dangerous world where evidence isn't required much, we need to actually be champions of evidence at the moment and say, why are you making this decision? Do you have evidence to pick your decision up?
And it's like, what counts as evidence as well? So
scrutinizing it. Well, so, vital, isn't it?
Yeah, and the problem with evidence is you can always call for more evidence. So if you don't like an idea, you'd be like, well, I don't think we have enough evidence on that yet. And it always, especially in the early days of badges or any kind of innovation work I do, it's always, well, you know, we need to wait for the evidence to come in. But there's never enough evidence, and you're always looking back. So it can be like, oh, well, you know, that was a different world a couple of years ago, and the world's changed now, because now we're now post-Brexit, so we're going to need some evidence about that. And so I really liked, I think I mentioned last week that I'd spoken to Cheryl Grant, and she'd written a paper in collaboration with Mozilla about promising practices. So what that's doing is, it's not saying, here's shed loads of evidence with statistics, but it's saying, look at these areas where people are doing this work, and here are the outcomes they're seeing. And I feel like that is a more useful approach, because it's more collegial, it's much more respecting people's professional practice than the top-down, we're going to put some money into what ends up being, you know, policy-based evidence rather than evidence-based policy, and then disseminating this very small trial, which is focused on top-down intervention.
Yes, I think it's... I was trying to think. So really, we're talking about... So if you think about a school, a teacher changes something in their practice or adds something new in or does something new because the evidence in their mind that stands robustly of their knowledge of self, their knowledge of their processes, their knowledge of their pupils that they have at that moment or that time, and their school that they work in, etc. And they will make a decision based on whether that's a on whether that's a good idea or not, based on their expertise. And if you amplify that out to a school, that's kind of what you're going with. So you employ different people to do whatever job in that school. And if someone's responsible for the timetable and they want to make a change, then you listen to it and you back them or you don't, as a leader of that school or whatever, or as a leadership team. And you have the conversations and you try and make sure that the decisions that are going on within your organization are the best decisions possible, and write the policy and procedures based on that, and make the changes accordingly. And if people know what they're doing, they manage that change. I mean, that's a big thing, isn't it? Is managing actual change. So a lot of evidence possibly comes down to, because as we have said, evidence can be found for pretty much any decision that you want to make. You know, you have to go back to didactic teaching. You can make that.
So it's difficult to know. So Ilan Ezekiel pushed back and said, like, your conclusion's pretty weak, which I knew. Like, you need something stronger than, like, unicorns and rainbows. You need something which is a concrete, this is what we can do, which is a fair enough point. And so take an example, I don't know, parents being convinced that the MMR vaccine causes autism and pointing to study after study after study, which they claim shows that this is true. And... Yeah. You could say, oh, well, that isn't causation, that's just correlation. But however many times you provide evidence and they provide evidence, you're not going to change their mind through evidence. Because if we could change people's mind through evidence, we wouldn't have an American administration, given the overwhelming evidence for climate change, we wouldn't have an American administration in the White House which had a bunch of climate change deniers in it. Like, a lot of it is emotion and human feeling, which makes it difficult to know how you actually change people's minds about stuff and how you base... Because there's a difference between... You know, when someone once told me, I think it was when I was doing teacher training, the government can say what they want about education and policy and practice, but it has to filter through so many layers that when the teacher goes into the classroom and closes the door, they have a lot of free rein about what they do. And so at the end of the day, you need to win hearts and minds as much as you have to do policy and, you know, get the whip out and the stick. You have to do the carrot and the hearts and minds thing as well, which is why I feel like an education system based on principles, which are which people can get behind, is much more important than, oh, well, this very, you know, detailed study we did over here proved this thing. Now we need to replicate and scale it. I don't think that's the best way of doing it.
Are you familiar with the situation of Tom Sherrington at Head Guru Teacher on Twitter?
You've mentioned him before.
Well, he's just been, he's just left his school, resigned from as the head of his school in Islington in London.
He was the one who's doing Trivium, yeah?
He was looking at doing Trivium, yes. So he's not but he'd gone into a school in 2014, I believe, as a head. And there was a lot of work to do there. It was a challenging school, and he assembled a team around him, and he was trying to do things in all interesting ways, and nothing was off limits, as it were, to look at and to do. And they faced a lot of challenges in education, behaviour being one of those within the school. And ultimately they got, I think what happened, and forgive me, Tom, if you're listening, which I doubt you are, if I get this wrong, and please do anyone correct me if I say anything inaccurate. But they were inspected, the inspection failed, they were failed at inspection essentially, and this led to him resigning. Now he has a blog post that he's written addressing some of this, and not all of it, but some of it, and essentially saying what we were trying to do is change the culture of the school. And there were massive amounts of progress being made, which has been supported by pupils and parents in the messages that he's received since he's left the position. But the Ofsted did not have any truck with any of that at all. They just weren't interested, and you know, the whole thing's being appealed and he can't talk too much about it, etc. But
I spoke to Bill Lord at BET about this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I think his school was on, you know, last strike, and he was going to be removed because it takes time to do cultural change, and you know, it turns out the exam results were good enough for him to stay, but you know, he was saying, look, this is the deal, like, you can't do cultural change overnight.
Yeah, and that's a big thing, isn't it? Because you're looking, I mean, first of all, it takes time to change your personnel. It takes, you know, to get people out, to let people leave who don't want to work under a culture that you want to develop. It takes time to get that through to everybody, and cycles of people coming through the organization, this includes pupils, to allow the sort of pushback behavior to desist and the more positive new culture to emerge. And it's a really, really difficult thing. People aren't prepared to back it, you know, and do certain things. And it might come down to chance in some ways, I guess, and sometimes it won't work. And how many years do you leave it? A bit like football managership, how long do you leave who is a proven manager who you appoint to your club? How long do you leave him in position when things aren't going well?
You mean like David Moyes at Sunderland, indeed.
possibly.
So that's a really important point, actually. So you look at people like Jurgen Klopp. So Jurgen Klopp is Liverpool Football Club manager, for those listening. And he went through a spell at the start of the year where I don't think Liverpool won for some like 8 matches in a row. But he's an extremely charismatic guy with a huge personality. And I don't think so, for example, if you tried to put Jurgen Klopp on a spreadsheet, you couldn't. And all these things, which are extremely important, like inspiring people to do stuff, all these things we know are important in life. None of it gets, you know, if we had to put that under evidence, it just doesn't get captured at all. There's no place for it.
I think that is interesting, isn't it? Because it's really hard. So if you look at another football manager, sorry if people don't watch football or soccer, if you're American. In the UK, but it's Jose Mourinho is a really interesting character. So he's been incredibly the most successful manager internationally going, and then he had an incredibly bad spell at Chelsea, and no one could really work out why it was. He lost the dressing room. He, you know, an amazing man manager. He had all of these inspirational things. He had it working. He had players that would lie over a puddle for him, you know, and that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, it didn't work. It broke when he came back, and it was to Chelsea to have another go. And it just went horribly, horribly wrong to the point that he was sacked. So they knew that he was an amazing manager. He has the best track record of anybody else in the world.
Yep.
And et cetera, et cetera. And still he wasn't good enough, and they had to move him on. And so if you're talking about evidence-based decisions, that's an interesting one. You know, at what point do you give up on someone? And in a school, what you've got... 2 years of poor performance.
Yeah, and then you're out and you're in. And it's interesting in that regard as well. And I think schools are becoming a lot more, well, they always have been managerial, but even more data-driven managerialism than previously. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty there is that academies and charter schools in the US and, you know, all those models that we're moving towards make it a lot easier to hire and fire people. And the upside of that is that, you know, you've got an opportunity potentially to make more money as a teacher. But the downside of that is that if your face doesn't fit, or if you don't fit the model, or if you don't, you know, produce the results immediately, then you're out in your ear. So you end up getting a very certain type of person in that school rather than the kind of maybe slightly quirky and eccentric inspirational figures that you might find elsewhere.
Yes, indeed. And it's
so just to bring it back to the solutionism thing, so there's someone called Yong Zhao, and they note in a blog post which accompanies an article that they wrote in the Journal of Educational Change. Sorry, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, actually. They wrote this article in the Journal of Educational Change, and the blog post is "What Works Can Hurt: Side Effects in Education." Now, a lot of the time, people use metaphors of from medicine, from the medical world, when they're talking about evidence in education, and they say, like, this is the way that medicine works. But as Yong Zhao points out, when you go to the doctors and you get some kind of medicine, or the doctor's giving you advice, or the surgeon, or whoever it is, they talk about the side effects. They talk about the downsides. So, you know, my father has been on a raft of medication since having heart failure. He knows what the side effects of that medication is, as well as he knows that it's making him better.
Yeah.
When we do stuff to do with evidence and education, and this is what works, we never get the side effects. And I think you had some comments on the particular form of language which is used in this post.
Yes, in this quote, so he says this program helps improve your students' reading scores, but it may make them hate reading forever. Now, I disputed this. So I have three children. Two of them have gone on to be educated at Oxford, indicating that they can read well and they've enjoyed reading. Mm. And they read the Biffin Chip reading ladder, whatever it is called, that you do when they were little. And they did not. It does not make you hate reading. It does not make you love reading. The books are about nothing. That propensity to read comes from, in my opinion, comes from human contact. So it comes from how you interact with your children and the books, how you read yourself, the model that you lay out as a parent for the pupils, not as a teacher.
But I don't think that's the same as some of the stuff they're talking about here, I have to say, with greatest respect. You know, we talked about accelerated reader and what my son Ben is doing at school. Uh-huh. So this is an automated program on the computer that does a test based on his comprehension of a book that he has just read. And based on his comprehension, he's only in chat with the computer, then he is allowed to progress on to other books, or he has to stay on the same level. Guess what? He doesn't read. He's listening to I think he's on to book 6 of Stephen Fry reading the Harry Potter books. But, you know, he's not reading as much as he used to now he's gone to middle school.
Well, I think, but it's interesting though, isn't it? Why? So I would argue that. So I've had this problem before, actually, with without wanting to mention names, so I'm going to name drop. But so John Humphreys, who does the Radio 4 morning show, I used to tutor his son.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and so John came to parents' evening one day, and we had a half an hour conversation, which is not really appropriate for parents' evening, about his son's reading.
Mm.
And I said, well, maybe what you need to do is to read the same book as your son at the same time, or to know the book that your son is reading.
Mm.
And then talk to him about what is going on and discuss what the author is doing with the characters and how the plot is going, et cetera, et cetera. And because I felt that was what that was why children learn to love to read, is because they are. It is a source of love, not just for the book itself, but in the first instance for the child. So sometimes that might happen, that they read something so inspiring and that it hooks them into that medium.
Okay. Well, perhaps that's too an emotive an example, but there's other ones there. For example, and this is an American example, school choice may improve test scores of some students, but can lead to the collapse of American public education. Which is a bit of a sweeping statement, but and it'll be difficult to actually test what's going on here. But yeah, it feels like we're not getting the full picture. We're not getting the downsides as well as the upsides.
Certainly that. I mean, it's certainly the case that I mean, and that's about the qualification system in general, which I'm sure you'd. Which is really what you're talking about, is the idea that the qualification step ladder, which is what, or highway, if you like, that we provide for young people in our countries, So walk this path and make these choices as you go and perform as best you can at these particular assessments, and we're going to try and help you get there. I love some of the writing that you have in your post, by the way, which about what is it, teaching to pass the test rather than teaching and assessing how well you have learned doing the learning. You basically teach people how to pass the test. And so you teach people all about the tests. So the quickest and easiest way is to teach the test.
So the paragraph that I, where is it, I wrote in here about teaching to the test, I was just like, if you want exam results to go up, then the quickest and easiest way is to teach the test. We might kid ourselves that there's different more expansive ways to do it, but the truth is that cramming and rote learning are the best ways to pass narrowly defined examinations.
Yeah. Right?
And I know this from experience.
And the pressure that we put on children to walk this highway. So I remember like grade inflation that's happened over years. So when I was at school, everyone didn't get A's, but now they do, or seem to think that they should. And that's a difficult thing because it's not measuring you. There was a sense of education when I was at school, which it failed to measure me entirely. Is that it's measuring how intelligent you are, how able you are to learn new things and take that on board and do things with them. Mm. I mean, is that a fair thing to say?
Absolutely. And I think that the more two-dimensional our measures are, and you can't get more two-dimensional than, especially in the post-Gove era of let's go back to as many examinations as possible. So this is in the UK. Our former education minister was Michael Gove. He got rid of a lot of coursework in courses. Now we're in a much more kind of high-stakes exam situation again. Then everything's very two-dimensional. And
guess what? An illustration of that very point. So right now, my current year 11, who are 16-year-olds doing their GCSEs, going out of school, have just finished a piece of programming coursework, controlled assessment. On their specification, they have two of these pieces of coursework, which are 30% of the final grade each. So the current year 10, the year below them, have started a different specification. And for them, it's two 40% written papers and one controlled assessment of the same size as the previous two, but only worth 20% of the final grade. But when you talk to the pupils who are just finishing up their programming controlled assessment, just finished it before the half-term holiday, they were so in awe of themselves at what they had achieved, putting together a sort of between 20 and 50 page document which detailed their work and documented their work and explained their programming and how they'd solved the problem and how they'd overcome their issues and debugged and whatever. And to assemble that in a professional style where it's content paged and page numbered and references are built for all the different sources and websites because they're allowed internet access during the controlled assessment and all of that sort of thing. So a really sort of pucker piece of work. These 15, 16-year-old children are really proud when they've achieved it and made their program work. That's a computer science thing. But the documentation side is not. The documentation side is a wider thing that they will be doing potentially quite a lot through their lives as they build reports and do different.
And there's so much in that, isn't there? I mean, I can still remember making Match of the Day out of plasticine for media studies GCSE, making a torch actually out of wood as a prototype. You know, my wife did the same thing, obviously, in the other end of the country. She made a little playground. And I can remember some of the things I'd learned there about, for example, from a teacher's point of view later on about, oh, so we all got different grades on that, even though we worked together about how you pull your weight, how you tell who's doing what, all that kind of, and just learned so much. And I think one of the things there is the fact that you're making something which is of value outside, like the audience thing. You know, people talk about boys blogging and the importance of that because there has a audience bigger than just the teacher and them.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of thing here. You're creating something which you can point back to and said, I did that thing, like your students. And also you can show people and say, look at this thing I made, rather than just the examiner.
Yes, exactly. But they won't be showing anyone this piece of work, but I agree with that point. But it's just that sense of achievement, a sense of building something that's greater than the sum of their own parts, if you like. It somehow stands up when it's finished. It stands up as something that they have achieved and can be proud of. And that sort of feeling, that possession of that ownership of the processes that went into that, those hours and hours and hours, it's a 20-hour controlled assessment, plus all the research and prep work that we do for it, in accordance with the guidance set out by the board, is substantial. And and I wonder if they're going to get that experience anywhere else. When I look at other departments' coursework, my knowledge of it, which isn't great, it's always quite small, it's quite thin, whereas this is a really substantial piece of work, and it's a real value, I think, to the young people that have to undertake it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I was going to say about the narrowly defined exams, that ends up having so many effects on wider society. So in state schools, it leads to... There was something I read about the future of work, which said something along the lines of 10% of people are going to earn salaries of like $10 million a year, and 90% are going to earn $8,000 a year. Like, there's going to just be massive stratification. And we've talked before about the hollowing out of the middle of anything. There's like the amazing shiny stuff, and then there's like the bottom end cheap stuff, and there's nothing in the middle, whether it's supermarkets, software, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's almost like that stratification, especially with automation and robots in the future of society. And we need to work more, I would say this, more cooperatively, and we need to work more fairly. And so while we're all against each other in a two-dimensional landscape, those who have are going to be able to get tutors, amazing education, move houses to close by amazing state schools, have cultural capital from their parents and from anything that they can gather. And examinations just, to me, perpetuate that, whereas project-based stuff is a lot more about the personality and how the person has decided to create this thing, and is much more individual than this two-dimensional thing. And I could go on at length about how that's perpetuated through the hiring and recruitment system and how that's all broken as well, but I'll leave it there just because I think we want to focus on evidence.
Well, yes. I mean, speaking of evidence, I thought it was quite interesting. One of the great evidence something that people would hold stock by as evidence is Elon Musk. And so he said, was it last week, I think, he gave some kind of worldwide conference talk saying similar things to what you've just been saying. Automation is coming. Mm. Universal income is going to be a reality very soon. We need to sort of start looking at it and doing what they're doing. Space travel is going to be like as accepted as air travel in 50 years' time. Self-driving cars are going to be competing against human cars within 10 years, et cetera, et cetera. And he gave all these sort of scares to the world, and that will be used as evidence in which to affect change in society, one would have thought, because he holds such a well-renowned position.
It's a difference between people saying it and people nodding their heads versus trying to change the system, which has got so many moving parts that we've discussed before. It's really difficult to know how you can make an incisive change, especially when you have to kind of rebuild the plane as you fly it.
I think that's right. I think so one of the things that came out of my trip to San Francisco and the pupils' experience of going to San Francisco and visiting all these big tech corporations that they went to, like Facebook and Google and Tesla and whatever, was that the digital divide is not just digital. It's, there's going to be a massive economic divide between, as you just said, the haves and the have-nots. The people who are able to make changes in their life that affect their kin in a very positive way, and the people who are not, the people who are going to
I was just randomly reading the sport pages of the newspaper the other day, and there's a guy, I've forgotten his name, but he got really into, he turned on the American football on the television. And got to go and see a game, I think, that was held at Wembley, and got really, really into it. And he's a big guy, tall and wide and all that kind of stuff. And his parents paid for him to go over to the US. I think it was a, you know, a bit of a stretch, but, you know, sent him over to relatives in the US, and he's, I think he's just become a draft pick for some, you know, big money, whatever. And you just think, well, that's a big sacrifice for the family, but it's also you have the capacity and the means by which to do that. So it's not like there wouldn't be other people who are in that situation, but they just can't do those things. And yes. Again, it's kind of a level playing field situation and social justice.
And it's one of those things. So it's like no one in my family did a degree before me, and so even though it wasn't necessarily such a moving feat, or it wasn't such a great thing for me, I just went and did it and had a good time. I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing there. Then my children go on and they tackle their education differently, and it passes, the culture changes through the generations as experience changes, and that's when I guess the social capital that you get from being or having a successful education and how that changes through the years, and that will be different in lots, in every different context that will be slightly different, but I think there is a genuine sort of shift in progression along these lines, which happens over generations within families. But then equally, it's a diluted and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, it can go both ways, can't it? I guess. I'm reading some stuff about how geniuses are made. Been reading that recently, and it's never that person themselves pulling them off from their own bootstraps. It's always there was something in the air, you know, like with Darwin, there was someone else who was talking about that stuff at the same time, and there was just something in the air. Or, oh, well, this person came from three generations of educators, or, you know, their dad was a well-known physicist, or their mother invented this thing, or whatever it is. You know, like, I think sometimes we focus too much on individuals and individual genius and brilliance, when actually it's systems and context and situations that make people, and luck as well. So I just want to quote Carl Gombrich, who's an academic at the University College London, UCL, mm-hmm. On his blog, which was kindly linked to in Slack by Oliver Quinlan, who was very helpful in the writing of this article, I have to say. So Carl Gombrich says, outside of science and mathematics, moral advances are made, for example, in extending voting rights to women or rights and equality to homosexuals, when first individuals and then groups make the case that the status quo is morally unacceptable and must be changed. There is usually nothing we could call evidence for these claims at the time that they're proposed, and even afterwards what we might call evidence for the importance of these advances is sometimes hard to establish, at least without invoking other norms which are disputable. Yet I hope no right-minded person would dispute that many such moral advances are indeed advances. End of quote. So there was a really interesting podcast I think I mentioned on here that I listened to a couple of years ago, and it was talking about, I think it was on In Our Time, BBC Radio 4 one, and it was talking about whether you could be historically disappointed. Oh no, it was Philosophy Bites, that's right. It was talking about whether you could be historically disappointed if you found out that one of your ancestors was actually in favor of slavery at a time when the abolition movement was in full swing.
I think this is quite interesting. So this is how I approach most things. I kind of think, when I look back in history, I kind of think, well, who would I be at that time? Mm. What, you know, if I had been born at that time, who would I have been? What would have been my life have been like? And what decisions, what might I thought and what decisions might I have been making? And I think I think your only assumption, if thinking that, is that you are the person as a white middle class man, you are the person that's supporting slavery. Do you know what I mean?
No, exactly. I mean,
because that's what everyone was doing, and that is the thing that I pick up from the historical analysis of it, is that
I'll tell you what's amazing for this. So, you know, we've mentioned Dan Carlin's Hardcore History before, and I think you might listen to a couple of episodes. Mm-hmm. He's recently released one on the atomic bomb. And the nuclear age, and it's 6 hours long. It's a blitz edition, which is supposed to be a faster, quicker one, you know, rather than the, you know, four lots of 4 hours he usually does. And I must be about halfway through, but the thing he keeps going back to is exactly that. Like, imagine that the atomic bomb was given to Hannibal when he was attacking Rome. Do you think for a minute he would even have, like, deliberated and thought about it? Or do you think he would have just gone, boom, bye-bye, Rome? And it's interesting to try and think about what you would do given the norms of that time and the normal ways of thinking. I did read something the other day that said something along the lines of the number of complex things that just the normal everyday person understands in this day and age would have taken a genius to understand, 100 years ago in previous generations.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's always the way. So when your belief has kind of led to the idea that people are racking their brains over what to do. If you think about our media, so or our entertainment, I don't know, our books, our films, our stories that are told, they involve somebody who is racking their brains over a moral dilemma kind of thing. You look at Lord of the Rings, you look at Harry Potter, you look at whatever, there's a sort of moral compass clearly on display and which path to take. And we're given the impression that these decisions are deliberated, but quite often I would imagine that in the context that the decisions are not deliberated at all, and it's kind of...
No, indeed. I think that's the usual state of affairs. My wife's looking at a job at the moment. I'm not going into any details, but she was looking at this job advert, and she's like, oh, yeah, but, I'm not sure if I could do that thing or whatever. And I was like, well, just remember that the HR person who was on a deadline to do this probably copy and paste a lot of this and just, knocked it out in not very much time at all. I don't think they're taking as much time to produce it as you're taking to infer what they want from it.
Mm.
It's a similar kind of thing, when we think that people are really, thinking deeply about the stuff that we care about. Possibly not. I did want to just put in one thing from Seth Godin. Did you see this? Our worldview casts a shadow in the words that resonate.
No, I didn't see this. This was in your blog, was it?
He's been on a bit of a run of form recently. So he's got it's 2017 and he's using a full-on HTML table as opposed to CSS, but hey, his job is a marketer, not a web designer. So in this table, on the one side, he's got, what I would say was a classic kind of conservative, slightly right-wing view. And on the other side, actually on the right-hand side, he's got what I would consider to be a left-wing view. Perhaps he's done that on purpose, just to mix things up, and he doesn't label them. There's no heading to the columns. But I guess what he's trying to say is that there are certain words which are used by groups of people, and if you can... I mean, he's talking from a marketing point of view, so if you can tune into what those people see as important, then you're going to strike a chord with those people. So, for example, one which really stands out for me is on the left-hand side, patriotism, nationalism, the homeland. And on the other side, community, ecology, the system. And, they're both...
As well, it says power, authority, compliance, respect, status. And the aligning row is fairness, hope, justice, connection, healing.
Hmm.
It's interesting. Profit-seeking versus public utility. Intuitive versus informed.
And so it's very difficult to talk to people who are, I think it's not a table, it's a spectrum, isn't it? And so the further someone is away from your side of the spectrum, the more difficult it is to talk to them because, they're pointing to different evidence. Well, they might point to the same evidence, but looking in a different light or using different ways to understand it, they're emphasizing certain things about society which are different from yours. It's not to say that those things aren't important. It's just that they think they're more important than you think they're important, and you favor things that they don't see as priorities.
Mm. So it's good. A lot of this sort of language connects to the different things we've been talking about. We've got effects on the left-hand side and side effects on the right-hand side.
Mm.
Quite like ends and means on the left-hand side, which is and means and ends on the right-hand side.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting thing, like the Kantian thing of whether you treat people as ends or whether you treat them as means. Obviously, Kant said that if you're treating people as a means to an end rather than an end in themselves, then you're not treating them in their full human capacity.
Mm-hmm. So a lot more of the words in on the, in the right hand column, sort of left wing leaning column. Are words that I would use in a everyday mind and conversation as well. Whereas, so there are certain things in the sort of right wing column that are like self respect. That's something I wouldn't object to, the sort of thing.
Yeah, and I always find it very difficult when people, you know, a lot of the time people will hide their real reasons for doing stuff behind a facade. But when I come across people who straight up say, well, my job in life is to earn as much money and to get as much status as possible, it's really difficult to argue against that. Because the whole of society is pretty much geared up for that. And it's like, well, you're playing the game as it's currently being played.
I mentioned it before. I remember I had a different political position to my parents growing up, and indeed still do, but less and less, I guess, as I get older.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I don't really think that's true. I think it's actually very different. but it was like... Should you vote on the basis, I think we discussed this election time, should you vote on the basis of this is the system and the setup and the party that are going to look after my position the best, and that's what I should vote for. And if everyone votes for that, then surely we end up with a fair system, with the best party in power, because of democracy. And that's in theory how democracy works. But life is not like that, is it? And it's quite interesting to be pigeonholed, labelled as a lefty, is a pretty, it's kind of like a damning thing, isn't it? Because most of successful society is not seen as left wing. Most of the organisations, you know, like companies that have profit motives, etc., they're not seen as left wing, are they?
No, I agree. And
this is where I think your passion for the co-op is coming from, you know.
Yeah, and actually, I just remembered this. I joined the Cooperative Party. I've never joined a political party before. I never felt that, you know, I've voted for Liberal Democrats, the Greens, and Labour before, but I've never felt like one represents me. And I didn't even really know the Cooperative Party existed, even though it's been around for 100 odd years. In fact, no, it's 100th year this year, because it you can join the Cooperative Party and the Labour Party, like they work together. Mm-hmm. And it's a small party, but I feel like it's in tune with my values. And in fact, you can only join the Cooperative Party if you're a member of a co-op, which seems like the, you know, right up my street. So, you know, it's £2-3 a month, and yeah, I want to get involved and see what I can do. And I'm not saying the Cooperative Party are immediately going to gain power, but for me, it's a similar situation to, I remember going to a conference once, and I spoke to two American academics, and they just joined a new university, a new private university. And this university had taken over a very small university in the middle of nowhere that was originally run by nuns and was about to shut down. They bought it, and then they turned it into like a qualifications factory and tried to move it to San Francisco. And these two academics had been brought in to, you know, the equivalent of the research excellence, basically give it legitimacy as a real university. And they were nice people. And they said, yeah, I know, like, it's a really shitty thing to do, but I try and feel like I'm changing things from the inside. And hey, if I didn't take the job, which is pretty well paid, someone else would have done. And I nodded and smiled and, you know, whatever, and was nice to them. But for me, that's the exact opposite of how I want to live my life. I think the Nietzschean quotation of, if you stare too long into the abyss and you fight dragons, eventually the abyss stares back at you and you become a dragon yourself. And so I have no truck with trying to change things from the inside, doing something because, hey, someone else would do it and I'm a better person than them, because I feel like people overestimate the amount of resistance they've got to, like avarice, all the seven deadly sins, basically. and so that leads me nicely onto another Seth Godin post, and we're getting well away from educational solutionism here, but hey, this is our podcast, so we can do what we want. This one is again a short one, and it's entitled "Nothing Wrong with Having Standards." And did we link to this last week? I'm not sure. I might put it in my newsletter. And it's exactly what I've just said. At the end of it, he says, you know, nothing wrong with having standards is the snarky feedback of someone whose bias is to hustle and serve to stand for something. And he says at the end, the thing is, if you begin with standards and stick to them, you don't have to become a jackal to make ends meet. Not only is there nothing wrong with having standards, it turns out to be a shortcut to doing great work and making an impact. So I feel like people who say that they have to do stuff to make ends meet, or this is just the way the world works, are giving up too easily.
Yes, my dad used to say, go back to my father, he used to say, there are people who change the world and people who make it go round.
Indeed.
He was one of the latter.
Yeah.
It's what he felt.
Yep. Yes, and it's all very well while it's paying the bills, I guess. But I feel as long as you can hold that line, not selling out is a good thing. Right, well, that was a bit of a ramble, but anything else to add to any of the things we've discussed so far, Dan?
I'd like to say, I think, going back to the original idea, is that I wouldn't make a decision without basing it on great thought, as in considerable thought, rather than great, as in good, and some evidence of different kinds. I would look for evidence of different kinds. So I think in the work that I do, and indeed the way I live my life, I look for different chunks of evidence, items of evidence to do with every different person's situation that I come across. I'm always interested in what motivates people, why it is that they're saying what they want to do, and always cautious that people aren't believing in something without the information that's at least available to them. That's all. Mm. So I think there is. So I would argue that when I think about this blog post title, I think if I was the leader of a school or an organization and I had people working for me that were bringing decisions to my table and for my comment, and I would ask about evidence. I would ask about what it is, and then I would scrutinize their evidence, and that's what I would do. What is your evidence for this? Does your evidence hold water? Mm.
And more than that, I think that every organization needs some kind of manifesto so that you can draw a circle and say, this is beyond the pale. This is not the kind of people that we are. Or this is the kind of people we are, and this is the kind of evidence that we look for when we're... And I think the process of doing that, of forming some kind of manifesto or some kind of mission for the organization, even if the mission is get as much money as possible, there's always going to be some stuff that the organization can't or won't do. And also, if you then have the discussion, especially in an educational setting, of what counts as evidence for us, then you'll quickly realize that the kind of evidence that we want to use is very different from the kind of very statistical, very quantitative, kind of let's put it in a spreadsheet kind of evidence that is being used in a top-down way. Something which I don't think we've mentioned yet is that one of the things I point out in this draft article, which I am going to rewrite, is the Philosophy for Children program being tested by the Education Endowment Foundation. Have I mentioned that yet? No.
I know, it's in your
So, newsletter. As a philosophy graduate, I think Philosophy for Children is a great thing to do. And, you know, when you look at what it's for, you know, the way that it describes itself, then they say that the reason why it's important is because it's an inquiry-based approach to open up children's learning through the exploration of ideas. But the way that it's being tested as to whether it has value in UK education is whether it increases maths and English test results at key stage 2, which is, what, age 11?
Uh-huh. That's crazy.
So if everything comes down to, oh, if they're 11 years old, then it has to improve maths and English key stage 2. Or if it's 16 years old, then it has to improve their GCSE results in, what, Progress 8 or whatever. Then obviously no measure is going to work for things which we value, like, I don't know, getting kids outside and communing with nature, or philosophy, or anything that we think is important. It's always going to be hard-nosed subjects, engineering, things that have jobs, STEM, you know.
Yes, things that have jobs. Yes. I see the purpose of this. I don't know, we do that quite well here. We have Trivium and whatever. It's kind of cool.
But then you are outside of the state saying this is what is going to happen in your school.
Yes. I think it's really interesting. I remember my daughter participated in a program they implemented at our school on emotional intelligence, which I've talked about before. And when it was come to evaluate that, they came in to interview the children. And she was so primed with what she had to say and didn't believe a word of it. She hated all of the sessions, thought they were rubbish. And I didn't say that whatsoever when she had cameras turned on her and people she didn't know asking her questions. You know, so...
Yeah, I had an emotional intelligence test once. It came back negative.
Excellent. Did they give you a shot for that?
I refuse to have it because it causes autism.
Oh, I thought you had it.
Thank you.
I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? But it does come back to the point. To the point, to just bring this back to sort of a nice circle, I guess, is that when you're looking for evidence of what works and what doesn't work, I mean, they're not stupid. They've clearly thought through that idea of, like, we need to bring this back to baseline data. And that's why they've done that to the English and maths. They're going to look at this and they're obviously so convinced that this is a good thing to do that they're willing to
sacrifice to
those scores, you know?
Well, but then that's the Hawthorne effect, isn't it? You know, we've talked about this before, the 1950s was it, when they went into factories and they changed the lighting and, oh my goodness, productivity went up. And then it fell off a bit and they changed the lighting back and productivity went up again, because if you do any kind of intervention, then people respond to the intervention. And yes. So, you know, I'm sure, because they're professional researchers, I'm sure they know all this kind of stuff, but I can't help but think there's going to be an element of, here's the results we need. So guess what results we're going to get?
Yeah, exactly. And then so it doesn't actually matter of the quality of what's going on at all. And so I had an interesting conversation with somebody today, which is that because we're a selective school, we get great results. But we get great results because we're a selective school and not because of the teaching and learning that goes on within our classrooms. And this is a really interesting thing, because we have children whom we don't believe are necessarily going to achieve very well, and yet they end up doing really well. And so our school is rated very highly for things that it does outside of the classroom, particularly. So things like having its own ad-based newspaper that it distributes around the entire community. That's not about the school, if you see what I mean. And other things like that. So, you know, we're the only FM radio station in the country in a school and that kind of thing. So it's a really interesting idea that it doesn't matter what you do in the classroom, and that there is. And so someone said this sentence to me: there is evidence that says that children will get the grades that they are destined to get, no matter which school they're at. And I thought, that can't be true. Is what I thought when someone said that to me. I thought it was
no, exactly.
That's a crazy statement, because a school has so much impact. And yes, to a degree, I agree with it. I can see where that comes from in certain cases. And I've certainly taught people in dreadful schools who have gone on to do very well. I talked about one of them not long ago, a gentleman, a Ukrainian man called Michael Pinnikas, who I used to teach, and did incredibly well, despite the fact that the school was going through major turmoil. For all of the time that he was there. I don't know. So there are instances where that I know that that's happened, but I can't believe that in the main, that's the case.
You know, I came across something a while ago which really gave me pause for thought, and it wasn't this exact article, which I've just pasted in there in massive writing. It's on How Stuff Works. It's called Like Parent, Like Child. Does Parenting Make a Difference? But again, and this is evidence, apparently, but it comes from twins and following and tracking twins and how they end up and all that kind of stuff. And it may be twins who have gone off for adoption and one's end up at a more affluent family and one's on the wrong side of the tracks or whatever. But you find out, for example, they both ended up as alcoholics, or they both end up doing really well and going to amazing universities, even though one went by a very circuitous route or whatever. And the point was that, yes, parents can make kids even better versions of themselves, but so much of it is programmed that parenting has a... it's almost like John Hattie's effect sizes. Parenting has a very small effect size.
That's an amazing thing, isn't it? That's an amazing thing to say, that parenting has a very small effect size.
And I feel like I can't believe that.
I feel like you're right, but maybe you're looking at, I don't know. So you're looking at a thing where maybe there's a genetic disposition to addiction. Alcohol is the approved drug of society, and therefore both of these people became alcoholics because they have sort of genetic.
Yeah, my son's 10, right? I don't think I could have done this as a 6-year-old, so my daughter's 6, but my son's 10. If you'd asked me as a 10-year-old, does parenting make a difference? I probably would have said no. But now I'm a parent, does parenting make a difference? Yes. Which exactly takes us full circle as to whether evidence makes any difference to your opinion of things in life.
Yes. This is the thing I'm saying, is that as a teacher, you will change your practice based on your experience and what lies in front of you, what you know, or the information that you have at your disposal.
Right, well, I enjoyed that discussion. That was good. That was good. So, what are you up to, apart from sleeping for the next few days?
You know, I'm not sure I'm planning beyond sleeping. I have an interesting printing issue going on at the moment. So the printing costs have been exceeded by £14,500 for the first 6 months. And we need to work out how to curtail that and how to pass the costs on, because exam paper season is coming and exam papers will be printed past papers will be printed ad infinitum, as it were. So we have one department come in and they required 47,000 prints. So that's only 23,500 pieces of paper, but the print's coming out of the printer, and our kit is 5 years old because someone foolishly leased kit for 5 years, and it doesn't actually last that long, especially consumable kit, as in kit that goes through lots of wear and tear. so we have to work out a solution until we replace our printing system in the summer, our whole printers, and so I'll be dealing with that. I've got the new Surface books have come in, Surface Pros and things. So I'll be starting that project off. We've been giving them to the teachers and getting them set up on their teaching and learning management systems, which they're going to try 3 different ones off on different devices and then rotate the devices, but stick with the same system so they can get familiar with it and learn the strengths and weaknesses of each, hopefully. Actually, mostly I'll be sleeping, I think.
That's an amazing amount of paper, though.
Oh, right, yeah, that's just one department. That's why we're kind of worried. So that was, to break that down, it's quite interesting. So that was a 16-page exam paper. So they're all, 2 pages on a sheet and whatever, and double-sided. And so 16-page exam paper for 205 pupils, and there were 9 papers. That was one of them. And then it was an A-level paper at 40 pages with...
And you need to print them because they have to practice doing exam conditions, or?
No. Well, this is the interesting thing that we're looking at. So we're looking at the detail of what's going on. So where you print an exam paper that you have to write on, that's going to be marked, then that's obviously a valid print. But if you print an exam paper to provide a tree of past papers for a pupil to look at through the revision process, it's a good thing as a teacher, and it's something I've always done, but I always print my own kind of thing. And I don't. This is for one of the sciences. So it's a big department, as it were. And so they're there at the greatest convenience to the pupil and kind of under their nose, and they're away from distractions of computers as well.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And so it has a lot of benefits to it, which are quite genuine. So we just have to look at the system by which we're doing this. So one of the ideas I've sort of throwing around is to create folders of past papers that would actually be signed out to the pupils. But when you're talking 205 pupils, so it's where do you store all of that stuff in between time, etc. It becomes quite large, but really all we're doing is killing trees and a lot of those papers will never actually be looked at. But the point being is that if the academic purpose, the demand is there, you have to kind of serve that demand and work out.
Yeah, absolutely. Solutions.
So, but it's not easy.
Wow. So you're sorting that out this week?
We have to make a decision on it because we need to work with budgeting constraints. So, yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, so this is half term week. You had half term last week. This is half term week for me this week in terms of my wife and kids. So we hummed and hawed about what we're going to do. We considered getting like a last minute Centre Parcs deal. We've never been to Centre Parcs before. And we wanted to go cycling because my daughter Grace has just, recently within the last month, been able to start off by herself and cycle. And we went today and it was wonderful. And my son's got a new bike. And anyway, I did a bit of work today, a bit of work yesterday, and I'm doing this blockchain presentation. I'm putting the blockchain presentation slide deck with this organization's permission. I'll not mention who it is. I might have mentioned it last week, I can't remember. But I put that in there with their permission, and yeah, I'm quite pleased with it. And I'm presenting that tomorrow on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we're going to East Lothian. Now, when I was going to move to Gozo, that little island off Malta, when I worked at Mozilla, we considered moving, or in the back of our mind, we had three places that we were going to move back to. One place was Stamford, which is right in the south of Lincolnshire.
That's just up the road from me, that is.
Yeah, we're considering moving there. It's a lovely place. Morpeth, which is where we are, and just down the road from where we used to live and near where I grew up. And also, the other one was Dunbar, just inside Scotland. These are all on near the main train line down to London. And we ruled out Dunbar in the end because my wife wasn't as keen as Morpeth, given that we all lived in Morpeth. But we're actually going up near there to Dunbar and that kind of place because it's pretty flat and it's going to have decent weather and it's got lots of cycle paths. I've got a little cottage, so we're going to go there for a few days. And then I'm off to Rome to do some work at St. George's British International School on their inset day. They're just getting Firefly, which is the failure you mentioned before, but I'm talking about things from a more holistic educational technology, badges, whatever point of view. And then I'm coming back home and recording Tide with you again.
Oh my gosh. Well, let's hope you make it. That's a busy week right there, but you've got some fun times in it, so it should be good.
Yeah, it should be good. Yeah, so looking forward to doing that. But I don't know if anyone's been able to listen to it, hopefully not, but during this podcast, the wind is absolutely howling around my home office. So, yeah, it looks like we've got different weather on the way.
Oh, right. I've had the most beautiful couple of days here. It's been very mild. Sun was shining yesterday when I went.
Oh, yeah, here too. But, like, literally in the last few hours, it has started howling. Go and get some sleep. I'll put this out. And, thank you for listening, everybody. And do give us your feedback. As usual, you can tweet us at Tide Podcast, and you can join our Slack channel. If you don't know how to get into there, as someone mentioned this last week, then you can just tweet us. I'm at DAJ Belshaw, and Di is at Di Barnes. So thank you for listening, and Di, I'll talk to you next week after you've recovered from your sleep deprivation.
Thank you. Cheers, Doug. Have a good week, everyone. I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.